Coming up on KUCB News, winter weather has delayed completion of the Unalaska Marine Center and the PFD application reopens. Stay tuned.
Programming on KUCB is made possible by Redfish Electronics, now providing new, used, and refurbished computers, tablets, iPods, MP3s, phones, phone accessories, and flat screens. We also carry external hard drives for your digital storage needs. Redfish Electronics is located in the airport parking lot next to Northport Rentals. Redfish Electronics can be reached at 359-2205.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Zoe Sobel with some local news on Wednesday, January 9th, 2019. Cold, icy weather is delaying completion of the new city dock. This is the third time that the deadline has been pushed back. Most recently, the project was scheduled to be completed by January 15th. Here's Ports Director Peggy McLaughlin explaining the situation at last night's city council meeting.
Of course, we are feeling the pinch. The dock is great and ready to go, with the exception of that we can't guarantee the integrity of the pavers until the sanding is complete. And so we've got A-season here.
A-season kicks off January 20th, and McLaughlin says the city has already turned away barges because they can't have foot or vehicle traffic on the dock. What's holding up the project? First, the pavers got weathered out.
The two main items that are keeping the dock from being open are the pavers, and then there was some plates that needed to go in over some of the pin pockets and the tie-down pockets for the crane. Those have been installed, but they're going to have to be remodified. They won't meet OSHA standards.
If the city is unable to come up with a solution for the sanding and the plates in the next couple of days, McLaughlin says operations will be impacted. At the request of Turnagain Marine Construction, the contractor responsible for the project, they cleared snow and ice from the area. McLaughlin says there's also been discussion of using heat blankets.
Under the proper conditions, the amount of work is probably a couple of days, but it just means that we need to get the right conditions and have the dock clear enough of ice and snow so that we can inspect the work as well as complete it.
It's possible, McLaughlin says, that the dock could reach substantial completion when the bulk of the work must be done by Tuesday, the old final deadline. But she doesn't want to make any promises because she can't predict the weather. Even with the delay, McLaughlin says the $39 million project is still within budget, although there will be some smaller items like sealers from the concrete that will not be finished until the spring. When completed, the Unalaska Marine Center will have 1,600 linear feet of dock space, 800 feet of crane rail, and 168 hours a week available for scheduling. Eligible Alaska residents can once again apply for their 2019 Permanent Fund dividends online. The online application system reopened Monday afternoon following a nearly week-long shutdown. In a press release, the Alaska Department of Revenue reports that it had to close the site on New Year's Day due to a computer glitch, and the department has made assurances it will contact applicants who were using the online system when the glitch occurred. Online applications can be submitted until Sunday, March 31st, 2019. Paper applications are also available. The 2018 PFD totaled $1,600 under former Governor Bill Walker. Current Governor Mike Dunleavy campaigned on a platform of increasing the dividend this year, but only the Alaska legislature has the power to make that appropriation. Dunleavy told reporters and cabinet members yesterday that he disagrees with the Alaska Supreme Court on whether permanent fund dividends can be cut during the state's annual budget process. Dunleavy says dividends should be transferred automatically from fund earnings. The court says the money is subject to what's called a legislative appropriation.
That's their opinion. I see it as a transfer. I've always seen it as a transfer, and a lot of people see it as a transfer. The language somehow crept into the budget discussions the last couple years as an appropriation.
It's a legal distinction, but it also highlights a huge difference in basic budget assumptions between the governor and the last legislature. If the state pays PFDs like Dunleavy says, it means there will be significant cuts to state services or to the permanent fund's earning account. Dunleavy says state spending will match its revenue. That will require a $1.6 billion spending cut. That equals more than a quarter of the portion of the state budget the legislature directly controls. Dunleavy says his administration will fulfill campaign promises, including repealing the 2016 law that reduced some criminal sentences. He says he will introduce a comprehensive package that will increase sentences for drug dealers and others.
We are seriously looking at those folks that are preying upon Alaskans, our most vulnerable, our children, our women. And we're going to be tightening up those sentences for those particular crimes.
Dunleavy says his proposal to cut the budget will be available in early February. And he announced a tentative date for the State of the State address of January 22nd. A recent report from a prominent Catholic organization offers details about dozens of priests accused of sexual abuse who rotated through Alaska over several decades. The Jesuit West Province includes oversight of clergy associated with the Catholic Order serving communities in Alaska, as well as nine other states. In a lengthy document released in early December, more than 100 priests in those dioceses are named, along with details about where they were placed when the abuse is alleged to have occurred. The records go back to 1950. An accounting by the Anchorage Daily News found that 33 of the named priests had been appointed to at least one community in Alaska, and in most cases, multiple small rural towns and villages, predominantly in the western part of the state. The authors of the Jesuit West report cautioned that their investigation was not thorough. They list incidents when a claim of sexual abuse against a child or vulnerable adult was made and where it likely took place. Many of those allegations came to light as part of court filings, but do not represent guilty convictions in civil or criminal cases. Most of the accusations emerged after priests died. It's also likely the abuse claims from survivors in Alaska and elsewhere are underreported. In order to have a more accurate portrait of abuse by priests, Jesuit West says its files will be reviewed by an independent consultant in the spring of this year. For decades, Jesuit priests in the Northwest who were accused of raping Native American children stayed in ministry. The Jesuits are an order within the Catholic Church. As Northwest News Network's Emily Schwing reports, documents suggest many of these priests were hidden in Alaska Native communities and Northwest Indian reservations.
I spent months reading through hundreds of court documents and letters written by Catholic leadership.
All you have to do is a little grunt work, and you got to stay focused. That's what I'm saying. This is not rocket science.
This is Patrick Wall. I called him for help because the paper trail I was on was complicated and sometimes in Latin. Wall used to be a Catholic priest, but he left after he witnessed too many cases of clergy sex abuse. He believes he was trained as a fixer to work with victims and families after a priest was accused of sexual abuse.
Oh, when the families come in, that is so painful. Because all of a sudden they've got a new younger priest who they think gets it, who they think that can then give them some kind of pastoral and human response, you know, and that pain is so palpable.
Now Wall works with victims of clergy sex abuse at a law firm in Los Angeles. After working on hundreds of cases, he's convinced the Jesuits used Indian reservations in the Northwest and remote Alaska Native villages as dumping grounds for problem priests.
They had to import people that really didn't want to be there. And so they took the second and third and fourth dregs of the barrel and sent them to Alaska.
I'd heard this before, but I really wanted to know if it was true. Alaska was a frontier for Jesuit missionaries. They first arrived there in the 1880s. Even today, Alaskan winters are dark and cold, and people in remote villages still depend on hunting to survive.
The church basically owned the village in a way. It's a small, isolated place. The kids had nowhere to go. The priest is powerful, and a lot of those kids were forced to go to church.
There are more than 300 reported victims of childhood clergy sex abuse among Alaskan Natives. Until last year, the Jesuits' Northwest region, also known as the Oregon Province, included Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana. In partnership with the radio show Reveal, I looked into Jesuit priests accused of sexual abuse in this region. 80% of accused priests in the Oregon province worked in Native communities at some point in their careers. Elsie Boudreau grew up in one of those places.
And we have communities in Alaska that have had to endure the sexual abuse by clergy for generations.
Boudreau is from St. Mary's, a small Yupik village near the Yukon River in remote western Alaska. She's the youngest of seven, and she says at least two of her older siblings were sexually abused by a Jesuit. We found at least 15 Jesuit priests accused of sexual abuse served St. Mary's between 1927 and 1998. Boudreau was also later abused, and her abuser, James Poole, also a Jesuit priest, was first assigned to St. Mary's before she was even born. Documents show he was moved around after accusations started to surface.
Like, I can forgive, you know, one perpetrator, right? But to move to an understanding that it was the institution, the Catholic Church, that operated in a way that devalued our Yupik people, Indigenous people, that's unforgivable.
In 2003, Elsie Boudreau filed a civil lawsuit against James Poole and the Jesuits Oregon province. We found more than 100 Native communities, not only in Alaska, but throughout the Northwest, where accused priests worked. And in some cases, Jesuit leadership would remove an accused priest and send him to another predominantly Native place.
Hi, Father Whitney. Emily Schwing. Nice
so I went to Seattle to talk with a Jesuit who was once in charge of the Oregon province, Father John Whitney.
Can I offer you some coffee or anything?
He's an admitted coffee snob with office bookshelves packed with philosophy
Aristotle's
books.
Aristotle's Metaphysics, Plato.
He even has a model of the Last Supper made out of Lego bricks.
Oh my God, look, Jesus is holding a baguette.
A baguette of bread, yes. French Jesus.
Whitney was appointed provincial in charge of Jesuits in the Northwest and Alaska in 2002. He says days after he took over, accusations of sexual abuse by Jesuits in remote Native communities became public.
Is it the people who are attracted to there? Is it because Natives were acculturated both by the civil culture and the church culture not to speak up? I don't know.
But here's what I do know from that endless paper trail I followed. I found a complaint from 2009 filed in Alaska Superior Court. It describes a Jesuit, Henry Hargreaves, as a serial child molester. According to his assignment record, he worked in more than 20 Alaska Native villages. When he retired in the early 2000s, Father Whitney sent him to live at a retirement home in Spokane. Whitney then assigned Hargreaves to say mass in communities on the reservations of the Colville and Spokane Indian tribes in Washington state.
What happened in some of these accusations, what was the reality of the event, I think was sometimes minimized.
But you're the one who signed off on putting Henry Hargreaves in Wilpinit and Ford.
And again, I think I did. I was always trying my best, and I know there were times I missed something.
Whitney says sometimes there just weren't enough priests to go around. But he insists he did not view Native communities in a way that would have devalued them. Other Jesuits, however, might not have felt the same way. I found evidence in church letters. One from Henry Hargreaves describes Native people as simple-minded. Another says Natives are not advanced enough to give honest and true testimony. When missionaries moved into Native communities, they didn't allow Native people to speak their own languages, sing their traditional songs, or practice their spirituality. Elsie Boudreau knows that story well.
I've heard many, many stories of how people were stripped of their identity. Sexual abuse was one way.
Most of the Jesuits who were accused of abuse in Native communities, like Henry Hargreaves and James Poole, were never criminally charged or prosecuted. So they didn't have to register as sex offenders. Some retired to a quiet home on a university campus with a well-known law school and an even better-known basketball team, Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington.
Tomorrow at noon, correspondent Emily Schwing finds out where victims and abusive Jesuit priests are today in the Northwest. The reporting for this series is done in partnership with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. And that's the news from Unalaska. I'm Zoe Sobel. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. Find us online at kucb.org. Please stay tuned for your local and marine weather forecast.